corridor into the other pool with a roar like Waikiki's surf, back and forth, breaking up the dark crust that constantly formed from the cooling of the surface. You had to keep reminding yourself, that's rock, as great orange sheets would get sucked under, leaving a bathtub ring and slinging white-hot gobbets up to stick and darken on the black sides of the caldera. And you had to keep stepping back from the rim to cool your face. As evening fell, the hovering cloud of steam and ash glowed red underneath, reflecting the molten magma and rivaling the sunset. During the night, we drove to where we could watch the bright orange lava streams pouring down toward the sea. Using the Mediterranean notion of vision and stating things without the like, you could well have said that we watched two terrible monsters, as alike as twin sisters, passing an eye back and forth between them. While not far away, amid the long red tendrils that snaked and hissed their way down the shoulders of the mountain, what had been trees and houses and ancient shrines turned into a great field of stone. Consider now the following famous Greek myth of Perseus, pieced together from the entry for Danae by Hyginus, a late classical collator, plus the version by Apollodorus. I will try to emphasize the phrases of special interest. Danae was the daughter of Acrisius and Aganippe. Of her there was a prophecy that whoever she bore would kill Acrisius, fearing which, Acrisius shut her up inside a wall of stone. In Apollodorus, it's a bronze chamber. But Jove, Zeus, turning into a golden shower, lay with Danae, from which union Perseus was born. Her father shut her into a chest with Perseus because of this affair, and threw it into the sea. By Jove's will, it was carried off to the Isle of Seriphus. There, the mother raised her son. Eventually, the king of Seriphus, Polydectes, ordered Perseus to bring him the head of the Gorgon Medusa, a task intended to get rid of Perseus so Polydectes could marry the unwilling Danae. Guided by Athena and Hermes, Perseus set off to Enyo and Pemphrito and Dano, terrible. They were the offspring of two monsters, Keto and Phorkys, and sisters of the Gorgons, Grii, meaning old, from birth. The three of them had one eye and one tooth, and they passed these to each other by turns. Perseus got hold of these, and when the Grii demanded them, he said he would give them back if they would tell him the way to the nymphs. The nymphs gave him three gifts, a special bag for Medusa's head, a cap that made him invisible, and winged sandals. After getting from Hermes an adamantine sickle, he flew to Ocean and caught the Gorgon sleeping. These were Stheno, strength, Eurale, wide leaping, and Medusa, queen. Only Medusa was mortal. For this reason, it was for her head that Perseus was sent. Those that saw them, they turned to stone. Apollodorus describes them with bronze hands, golden wings, and snaky scales. Like Pindar, Pythian Ode 10, most other authors, and ancient sculptors too, insist that Medusa's head was covered with hissing, writhing snakes. The early pot painters, for their part, depict the Gorgons with large cauldrons for heads, a detail not previously explained. Perseus avoided petrification by looking only at Medusa's reflection in his bronze shield, as, hovering above her while she slept, he severed head from body with his divine weapon. When her head had been cut off, the winged horse Pegasus sprang out of the Gorgon, and also Crusader, the golden sword. These had been sired by Poseidon. Escaping Medusa's angry, shrieking sisters, thanks to his invisibility, Perseus returned home just as Polydectes was closing in on his mother. By whipping out the Gorgon's head, he turned the evil king and his men to stone, where they stand to this day on the rocky isle of Seriphus, and rescued Danae. Soon after, competing at some athletic games, Perseus threw a discus stone, which the wind caught, so it hit and killed a spectator, none other, it turned out, than his grandfather, Acrisius. The oracle was fulfilled. It is hard to find anything in this tale that does not smack of Vulcanism. Crusader means golden sword. Compare both lava fountains, which can shoot straight up in the air like a tall flashing blade, and the same image in a description of fiery doom that comes from Iceland, where lava fountains occur frequently. Surt, black, swarthy, will ride first, and with him fire blazing both before and behind. He has a very good sword, and it shines more brightly than the sun. The name of Pegasus, the winged horse who becomes Zeus's thunderbolt carrier, can now be connected linguistically with the Luvian Hittite storm god Pichishashi, suggesting even more strongly that the broad-winged creature, willful as always, seen rising suddenly above the mountain at the moment it loses its head or top, is the ash cloud. For petrification, compare the spontaneous remark of a child in the Congo concerning the now active volcano Nyiragongo. It's going to explode. I'm ready to run because if it catches me, it will turn me to stone. That's what happens, you know. As for the Gorgon's cries, consider a description of Mutnovsky, a volcano on Kamchatka. The jets of steam so hissed and roared that it was necessary to shout in order to be heard. Or the 1928 eruption of Mayon in the Philippines. Lava poured out through the notches in the crater wall and followed the gullies, forming snake-like trickles radiating from the summit. There was a periodicity of 3 to 5 hours in the spells of roaring, hissing, cracking, and tumbling noise. Volcanoes frequently produce far more than bangs and rumbles. Athena is said, for example, by Pindar in Pythian Ode 12, to have invented the double flute in an attempt to imitate the sounds of Medusa's sisters bewailing her demise. We found this unrelatable to volcanoes until we read such eyewitness accounts as that of the 1779 eruption of Sakurajima in Japan. The noises were as of the cry of some mountain birds. Or Mutnovsky again. White jets of steam shot whistling and blustering out from holes in the cliff. Just which volcano or volcanoes instigated the Gorgon legend, however, may be lost forever in the mists. Seriphus, though extremely rocky, is not a volcano. Its neighbors, Milos and Thera, are. But the multiplicity of volcanoes, the Graiai, the Gorgons, their parents, and the decapitated Medusa's two offspring, suggest a much bigger volcanic field with multiple vents like Etna, unless Thera was so configured before its decapitation in 1625 BC. It has two vents even today. Pindar's Pythian Ode 10 sets Perseus's deed in the land of the Hyperboreans, the northern ends of the earth, possibly the volcanoes of the Caucasus, and Pegasus's name points to Anatolia, whereas others say Perseus threw the Graiai's eye into Lake Tritonis in Libya. And Apollonius Rhodius depicts the venomous snakes of Libya as descended from drops of blood that dripped from Medusa's head as Perseus flew homewards. Volcanoes do exist in Libya, although geologic information is hard to come by. If the story has been brought in with migration from or travel to other lands, then our chances of tracing it plummet. Chapter 11. Compression. Methuselah and the Eponymous Heroes.
"Tell old Pharaoh to let my people go." An old spiritual.
Principle of attraction. Once the stories around something, for example, a hero, achieves sufficient mass, that thing or whatever attracts yet other stories to him or her or itself via any significant point of resemblance. Points of attraction include the same type of event, same place, and same name or clan name. The memory crunch problem that we identified right at the beginning, that only so much memory space is available in a non-literate society, gets unexpected help from the principle of metaphoric reality. For when the distinction between two things perceived as similar gets obliterated, such that the object or event Y is no longer merely like X, but partakes of X, or even is X, that is, when two things originally viewed as related come to be viewed as one, suddenly there is less to remember. We have achieved compression of information by a type of conflation in which likes attract each other. Take, for instance, Theseus, the great hero of Athens. He gained his greatest fame for killing the Minotaur and the brigand Procrustes, but many other adventures are told of him. In fact, if something happened at Athens, you can be pretty sure you'll be told that Theseus did it. Attraction by place. Storytellers still pass down the important event, but if the place is known, the doer may be automatic. If it happened around Ohio, Johnny Appleseed must have done it. Similarly with Heracles, famed for prodigious strength. If something occurred that would have taken enormous strength, search not for the agent. Heracles must have done it. Attraction by quality. Thus, if a Greek river moved its channel radically in a single day, in Asia both the Tarim and Yellow rivers have the noxious habit of doing this, Heracles must have moved it. If a terrible beast needed killing, like as not, Heracles did the job. Others have noticed this process. Lord Raglan quotes a book from 1823 on Robin Hood lore as commenting on everything of a marvelous kind being attributed here in northern England to Robin Hood, as it is in Cornwall to King Arthur. H. J. Rose, in his thoroughgoing Handbook of Greek Mythology, occasionally remarks on it also. At one point, he lists the children of two rather volcanic-looking monsters, Echidna, half-woman, half-snake, sister of the three-bodied Geryon, who lives on Red Island, and Typhon, who carries on like an explosive volcano, as including Orthros, Geryon's herd dog, Kerberos, the hellhound with a voice of bronze and 50 heads, who became the watchdog of the underworld, the many-headed Lernaean Hydra, the fire-breathing Chimera, and finally the Theban Sphinx, or Pyx, and the Nemean Lion. The simple lion seems a bit of a come-down after all the fantastic multi-headed monsters. Rose then adds, "We may be sure that the Nemean Lion would not have figured in this group, but for the fact that he, like Kerberos and the Hydra, was associated with Heracles." Call it attraction by association. On the other hand, if something in the Bible happened in Egypt, Pharaoh was involved. Which Pharaoh? Who knows? They have all collapsed into an undifferentiable Pharaoh. Attraction by title. Many scholars have suggested independently that the same thing occurred on Crete, since to the Greeks, no matter what happened on that island in mytho-history, it involved King Minos. Minos may have started as a title. It also can happen that an individual's name becomes a magnetic title. Russian Tsar and German Kaiser came from Caesar, the family name of the great Roman rulers Julius and Augustus. And the Russian word for a king in general, Karol, came from Carolus, the Latin form of Charlemagne's name, Carolus Magnus, Charles the Great. But once the name becomes a title, those who take the title may gradually blend together in oral tradition. Identical personal names, too, can trigger attraction. Rulers often take identical throne names, which we today carefully distinguish with numerals, Henry VIII, Elizabeth II. Amenhotep III did not think of himself with a numeral, of course. We have numbered the pharaohs for our own convenience. All around the world, however, yet another force works to cause attraction by name. Many cultural groups believe that the souls of ancestors return via the newborn children of the group. Mother's new son looks like recently deceased Grandfather George, point of resemblance. It must be Grandpa George, born to a new life, so we'll call the baby George, not just in Grandpa's honor, as we interpret the custom today, but in recognition of the child's identity. Now, take that common custom of naming the grandchild after the grandparent, still done, for example, in Greece, and run it through 6 or 7 generations of oral history. George I did X, George II did Y, George III did Q, George IV did Z. Lose the subscripts, and George looks like a busy guy, heroically busy with all those deeds, X, Y, Q, Z, rolled up into one lifetime. You may have noticed that a loss of perspective on time has figured into several of these types of attraction. In fact, time has its own curious modes of behavior that warrant special scrutiny. How, for example, can people just not notice that George I and George III lived 100 years apart? To understand the problem, first consider visual perspective. Put 2 big dots on a piece of cardboard, 1 toward each end. When you look straight down on them, you can see that they are several inches apart. Now, hold the cardboard so that one dot is at your end and the other is at the far end. Move your head slowly downward past your end of the board. Watch how the apparent distance between the dots appears smaller and smaller, until the dots seem to coincide, just as your eye finally drops below the edge of the cardboard. We call this foreshortening, of course. Now take the following pop quiz, no peeking for answers, and find out firsthand how the 2 ends of a century can do the same trick as the 2 dots. Within the following pairs of famous people, who lived first? A. Lyndon Johnson or Abraham Lincoln? B. Queen Elizabeth I or Isaac Newton? C. Pliny or Virgil? D. Solon or Themistocles? E. Cheops or Sargon? The first one is so obvious it seems silly. President Lincoln lived a whole century before President Johnson. But unless your English history is pretty fresh, you may have to struggle to recall that Elizabeth and Newton, too, lived about a century apart. Elizabeth came first. By the time we've moved back 2 millennia, we feel some pride if we know that the pair in D are Greeks and came before the pair in C, who are Romans. But who came first within each pair? The century that separates them seems disappearingly small from where we sit. Virgil before Pliny, as it happens, and Solon before Themistocles, with some 600 years between the Greek politicians and the Roman authors. Squint back another 2 millennia, and the images in E appear to coincide altogether, just as the dots on the paper did. Even archaeologists have to stop and search through their mental Rolodex from grad school to separate them. Cheops, builder of the Great Pyramid at Giza, lived roughly a century before Sargon the Great of Akkad. And for those who have no written history books to consult, this loss of perspective is even easier. Lord Raglan points out that English villagers a century ago could pit St. George against Bonaparte without the least sense of incongruity in their mummer's play. That's a gap of some 1,500 years. And with not even a blink, the average moviegoer accepts cavemen like Fred Flintstone coexisting with dinosaurs, a collapse of 65 million years. Perspective principle. As we get further from an event, our perspective gets flatter, and we can no longer distinguish earlier from later events so easily. It is all back then sometime. What wonder is it then that grandfather and grandson with the same name get conflated a few generations later? This predicament leads to another interesting effect. If George IV, who died recently, helped repair the temple after the big quake, but George, actually George I, also helped build the temple to begin with, then George lived about as long as the temple has stood. Yet the priests claim that the temple was built 200 years ago. That means that George lived for over two centuries. In fact, we observe this sort of thing happening sometimes in the Sumerian king lists. The scribe sees in his records a king here and a king there with the same name and concludes it is the same man. He also knows that this king did various deeds for which he has recorded dates, but the dates add up to a lifespan of many centuries, which he duly assigns to his king of that name. As we dig up more and more tablets from different places, we sometimes can piece together the data the ancient scribe lacked and see that this has happened. From this phenomenon, we get some of those numbers that seem so utterly fantastic to every child first hearing the begats in Genesis, numbers that also put Viagra to shame. When Jared had lived 162 years, he became the father of Enoch. Jared lived after the birth of Enoch 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after the birth of Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. Methuselah lived after the birth of Lamech 782 years, and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. Genesis chapter 5, verses 18 to 27. Phew! Methuselah effect. Deeds of identically named or surnamed relatives may get conflated over centuries, but if any independent gauge of time exists, then one has to ascribe centuries of lifetime to such heroes. If people back then could live to be many hundreds of years old then, and the next deduction now seems obvious, they were not built like us. They clearly constituted a race of supermen, living in a golden age when people could live for a millennium instead of, at best, a century. Hesiod knows of them. A golden race of mortal men, first of all, the deathless ones created, the deathless who have Olympian homes. These lived under Cronos, when he ruled in heaven. Like gods they lived, having carefree hearts, far from toils and misery, nor was old age evident upon them, but always the same in feet and hands, rejoicing in full heartiness, away from all evils. And they died as if overcome by sleep. All worthwhile things were theirs. From Works and Days. The chasm between them and us looms larger still when we consider their vast feats of strength, moving rivers, decapitating monsters, holding up the sky, and their often gigantic size. There were giants in the earth in those days, says Genesis. In short, the Golden Age phenomenon. The past comes to be seen as different in an absolute sense from the present. Giants, in fact, seem to have left evidence of themselves all over the place. In Sardinia, the megalithic tombs accompanying the prehistoric stone residence towers, ubiquitous on that island, are called Tomb di Giganti, giants' tombs. Archaeologists tell us that their name derives from local legends that identified these structures as graves of an extinct race of giants. In Greece, the classical folklorist Adrian Mayer has shown that the notion of giants got a boost from enormous fossil bones that occasionally washed out of the earth, usually from one of the abundant beds of tertiary fossils around the Aegean. The widespread notion that heroes like Ajax and Achilles stood about 15 feet tall received confirmation whenever the isolated bones of extinct elephants or rhinos were exposed. Because the femurs, shoulder blades, and other familiar bones do resemble giant counterparts of human anatomy, especially when the animal's skulls are missing. A mastodon or mammoth femur is roughly 3 times the size of a man's thigh bone. And 3 times 5 feet, ancient Greeks were shorter than we are, equals 15. Several ancient authors mention that giant bones were deposited in temples and the like, and in fact, fossil bones have actually turned up at the temple of Hera on Samos at Troy, and at the Nicoria, says Mayer. Such bones reinforced, of course, the notion of a former golden age of heroic people, gigantomachies and the like. Quite the opposite of the golden age phenomenon is the modern principle of uniformitarianism, which postulates that geology and biology, like chemistry and physics, have always behaved as they do now. Thus, data obtainable from the world right around us has the potential to explain the geological and biological events of long ago. Historians of science view the formulation of this concept as a great watershed in the development of scientific thinking, but the battle for its acceptance in the life sciences began as recently as 1833, less than 2 centuries ago, with the publication of Sir Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology. This book sparked a war with the reigning catastrophists, who insisted on the Golden Age model, a fight that raged another 25 years before scholars became widely convinced of the veracity of uniformitarianism through the rapidly growing evidence from geology and archaeology. Even today, however, many prefer the notion of golden ages, and the battle still continues in some of America's schools. Making the assumption that the overarching rules don't change, whether one is convinced of the principle or not, alters the whole game and can lead one, however slowly, to the data needed to figure out what the non-willful natural laws are. If, however, we subscribe to the Golden Age phenomenon, we can go a step further in another direction and conclude, by the UFO corollary, that if certain events are not understood according to already known natural principles, they must be ununderstandable, that is, supernatural, and there is no point in trying to understand them. They are automatically recategorized as different in an absolute sense from the known and understood. That is, if things need not follow the laws we see in operation around us, then we have no basis on which even to try to figure them out. So, funny lights in the sky caused by unusual but law-abiding meteorological phenomena could just as well be UFOs from outer space, or magical firebirds. The colorful Russian firebird that flies through the air at night was almost certainly a description of the Aurora Borealis. In Pasadena, however, where we have lived for decades, residents and police have learned simply to assume that funny lights in the sky result either from something sent up very high from Vandenberg Air Force Base, or from some new and cleverly engineered prank launched over the city by Caltech students. And cattle mutilations on the distant pastures of one's ranch can be blithely attributed to space aliens or worse, instead of to the host of small predators which have always helped themselves to unattended carcasses. We'll hear more about this in Chapter 12. The shallow-mindedness of television teams who put together specials on such subjects without learning from knowledgeable forensic experts demonstrates once again the fact that many people prefer the mystery and romance of the Golden Age hypothesis to reasoned logic and careful evidence. The general collapse of earlier time and events into one indistinguishable mud puddle is well known to cognitive scientists studying the origins of false beliefs, not to mention to people who are simply getting older. Stephen Sesse, for instance, collected the following example from a television trivia expert. "Dear Inman, was there ever a TV series called The Survivors? I remember it was about some people who'd been stranded on an island in an airplane crash. I also remember Lily Tomlin appearing on it before she was anybody. Could the time period be around 1969 or 1970? Rick, Great Falls, Montana. Dear Rick, gee, you've managed to remember most of the ABC Monday evening lineup from the fall of 1969 and mix all the shows together. The show you mention, The Survivors, was a dynasty-style soap opera. It starred Lana Turner. The second show about people stranded on an island was called The New People, and it aired just before The Survivors. And the third show, the one with Lily Tomlin, was called The Music Scene." Time interacts with analogy to compress things in other curious ways. Since every year it happens that the Nile floods its banks, then the muddy fields reappear and the crops grow and are harvested, the recurrent nature of these events may come to dominate one's worldview. People begin to ask not, on what date did that happen, but where in the cycle did it happen? Thus, the cyclic phenomenon. If events at two or more points in time resemble each other strongly, they must be related or even the same, and therefore returning. If the same events are seen to return many times, the observers may conclude that time is cyclical rather than linear. Such cultures may have a linear view of immediate time, but a cyclical view of large-scale time. Thus, in ancient India, the Sanskrit language had past, present, and future tenses for daily use, but one of the chief Indic deities was believed to cause a cosmic cycle of destruction and rebirth by his fiery whirling dance. No yearly dying fertility god this. Shiva, the destroyer, seems to represent the periodic collapse and reestablishment of all the celestial coordinates, the pillars of the world, every couple of millennia, as the sun precesses relentlessly through the 12 constellations of the zodiac. Recurrence of the same event across time creates one sort of analysis, but close succession in time of two different events creates quite another, that the first event made the second one happen. For example, we mentioned the scene in Black Orpheus, in which the little boys played the guitar on the hillside to try to cause the sun to come up. Post hoc, ergo propter hoc. After this, therefore, because of this. Because one event occurs soon after another event, the prior event is taken to have caused the later event. The Klamath medicine men jumped into the erupting crater, and soon the volcano stopped erupting. Therefore, their sacrifice caused it to stop. The town drunk died. Someone else died 4 days later. Therefore, the drunk must have become a vampire and killed the second person. I smelled a funny smell, then I got a headache, so I conclude that a toxic fume caused the headache. But however commonly we do it, as a form of reasoning, post hoc ergo propter hoc is fallacious. The fume may or may not have caused the headache. We need more evidence to know. Perhaps the funny smell was merely breakfast cooking, and maybe last night's 5 martinis caused the headache. As logician William Neblett puts it, it's like saying that because day follows night, therefore night causes day. At least with day and night, we have enough examples to determine correlation. One always follows the other. But if that was the first time I smelled that funny odor, I don't even have correlation yet, just temporal proximity. And spatial proximity may serve as well for jumping to conclusions. The corpse is in the kitchen, therefore the cook did it. Prope hoc, ergo propter hoc. The problem is that our brains are constructed to seek out patterns so avidly that they will happily pounce onto single cases and pronounce them patterns. Attraction through various types of similarity, quality, association, name, time, location, and so on, is not the only way data get compressed in mythology. Who cut off Samson's hair? Ask anyone. They'll all say it was Delilah. Unless they memorized Bible verses as children. In fact, after Delilah had persuaded Samson to fall asleep in her lap, she ordered one of her henchmen to come and cut the fatal hair. When Delilah saw that he had told her all his mind, she made him sleep upon her knees, and she called a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. Then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. The servant has gotten lost in the long chain of retellings, that is, in the oral pipeline. Delilah effect. As a story is retold and retold, the actions of the minor characters are eventually attributed to the major characters. At the same time that we blush for getting it wrong, however, we are saying inside ourselves, "So what? The important thing is that Samson lost his magical hair, and Delilah made it happen." Precisely. The reduction of characters has no effect on the key elements of the story. So, unless you were the servant and this was your one moment of fame, the loss does not matter. And in fact, this compression of information makes the story fit into the oral pipeline a little more efficiently. A definite plus. Because the Bible and its stories have been so important in Western tradition, they have generated a continuing oral pipeline of people recounting these stories. And because we have the Bible as a written text, we can go back and check out the form of each story that entered the pipeline and catch this principle in operation over and over. Ask people about the biblical flood, and they will tell you of Noah and his ark, filled with 2 each of every kind of animal, just as the folk song says, "The animals came in 2 by 2. There's 1 more river to cross. The elephant and the kangaroo. There's 1 more river to cross." If you press them, they may recall that Noah had a wife and 3 sons on board. Typically, the servants and other householders get lost. They add nothing essential to the tale. And what about the rest of the animals that came along? Quick, where's that mental Rolodex? What other animals? God, the Bible states, instructed Noah to put in 14 each, 7 pairs, of the clean animals, and 1 pair each of the unclean ones, plus 7 pairs of each type of bird. But since you need only 1 of each sex for reproduction, 2 of each species constitute the major characters for all practical purposes, and we can conveniently dispense with the rest. As a practical consequence, we can appeal for analytical work to the distillation factor. Stories with more characters typically have stayed in the oral pipeline a shorter time than stories with fewer characters, which have been distilled down to essentials. For example, the Old Testament, too, flowed through oral pipelines for many centuries before being committed to writing. But we have a much older written text which tells a flood story so similar that the 2 must have sprung from a common source. This older text, contained in the Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh, has even more people on the surviving boat than appear in Noah's Ark. "I loaded into the boat all that I had of gold and living things, my family, my kin, the beasts of the field, both wild and tame, and all the craftsmen. I sent them on board. I looked out at the weather, and it was terrible. So I too boarded the boat and battened her down. All was now complete. So I handed the tiller to Puzur Amuri, the steersman." From Sanders, 1964. This multitude suggests that the Sumerian story did not stay in the oral pipeline as long as the story of Noah did. The narrators have whittled it down less. Indeed, if some sort of actual event triggered these two flood stories, the Gilgamesh version, written down some 1,500 years before the biblical version, had 1,500 years fewer in the pipe. Consider in this light the Greek myth of Deucalion and Pyrrha. When Prometheus learned that Zeus was about to destroy mankind with a flood, he warned his son Deucalion to make a boat and embark with his wife Pyrrha. As the waters subsided, Deucalion and Pyrrha landed on Mount Parnassus, above Delphi, viewed by the local culture as the center of the earth, where they received divine instructions to repopulate the world by throwing the bones of their mother over their shoulders, which they did by casting stones, bones of Mother Earth, behind them. Here we are down to two humans and no animals at all, presumably a very long-told story. Not all such compressions to a small number of characters function in quite that way, however. Myths, folk tales, and rituals often bundle an entire class of possible individuals into a single persona who represents the class, as a king or queen represents, acts, and speaks for his or her people. Thus, for example, the Eastern Orthodox wedding ritual portrays the bride and groom as a princess and prince who come to the church to be crowned. The ritual makes it quite clear that the two individuals represent the actions and desired attributes of all such couples. As it were, the kingdom of fertile males mating with the queendom of fertile females. This differs from Zeus and Hera, who as king and queen of the gods represent all married couples, only in that the individuals are different with each enactment, but the titles remain the same. The English king and queen of the May function much the same way, as do myriad other royalty in traditional stories. The king of the sea, representing all its inhabitants, real or imagined. The bear spirit, representing all bears, and so on. We could call this type of compression the class action corollary. The attributes and actions of a class of beings may be represented as a single individual portrayed as king or queen of the group. Narrations not concerned with the regeneration of a species, of course, have no need to stop the whittling at two characters. One protagonist may suffice. And so we see it in story after story of yet a different type, that in which a single person makes a long journey, then begets an entire race or clan. Thus Io, stung by the gadfly, rushed off to Egypt, where she became grandmother of Libe and the Libyans, and great-grandmother of Aegyptos and the Egyptians. Perseus, after turning his enemies to stone with Medusa's severed head and being exiled for accidentally killing his grandfather, traveled to Asia, where he fathered Perses and the Persians. In another story, the sorceress Medea fled to Asia from Athens after attempting to kill Theseus's son, taking along her son Medos, who fathered the Medes after killing Perses, son of Helios. We know from Herodotus and other sources that the Medes and the Persians wandered around a good deal before settling in the Iranian plateau. But, like other Iranians, they moved as nomadic tribes. Far more likely in this case than one person moving and then spawning is that a group of people who shared the same clan or family name moved and resettled. Hence, the very frequent eponymous hero syndrome, in which the migrations of tribes are reduced to the journey of an individual, one who was or is seen as the leader or progenitor of the group in some sense. Conversely, a known group may be assumed to descend from such an eponymous, named after hero. The Greeks became so accustomed to such stories that when tradition did not include a specific ancestor for a given tribe or clan, They provided one by back formation from the name of the group, such that it is sometimes hard to tell which story went which way. Thus, the Hellenes were later said to come from a hero, Helen, son of Deucalion and Pyrrha, who in turn begat Doris, eponymous father of the Dorians, Iolaus, father of the Iolians, and Zeuthus, stepfather to Apollo's son Ion, who in turn begat the eponymous ancestors of the four Ionian tribes. Note that the fairest of them all effect has struck again, in that the Greeks here derive themselves from Helen, the only true son of the only survivors of the flood, whereas everyone else comes merely from the rock's throne. Rose tells us that eventually the Greeks became so accustomed to their poet's laureate inventing eponymous heroes that Corinthos, son of Zeus, was a person whom no one who was not a Corinthian believed in, and his very name became a synonym for a piece of tiresome nonsense. Notice, too, that the eponymous hero syndrome results from the principle of attraction by name, the perspective principle, and the distillation factor all ganging up together. Since everyone of a given clan could take on the name of the perceived progenitor, Heraclidae, Danaids, Volsungs, Scyldings, yes, the Germanic peoples did this too, it can quickly become unclear how many generations were involved in the migration or feud. As offspring of X, all members of the group become reinterpretable as the immediate children of X, with a consequent compression of both individuals and time. Reinterpretation of a data set inevitably leaves it open to restructuring, a tool that the human brain has used for eons to compress linguistic data into something manageable. Each child must learn its first language from the data it hears. But a simple strategy of imitating so many utterances soon overwhelms the memory banks. The solution is pattern matching so as to compress many component items into a few, over and over, layer after layer. Ride, rode, like drive, drove, like write, wrote. I pick, he picks, like I cut, he cuts, like I stop, he stops. For it is these multiple layers of patterning, with patterns at the syntactic level even bearing meanings, that provide the key to language's remarkable flexibility and infinitude, the key to linguistic complexity. Linguists are still documenting the successive waves of collection and compression that the young brain goes through. Random sounds yield to more manageable syllable types, the many syllables to a few phonemes, myriad speech chunks to reusable words and eventually morphemes, thousands of sentences to systematic syntactic types, and so on. Even at age 20, we still tumble to an occasional pattern we hadn't noticed before. Pattern matching, interpreting, structuring, compressing, and restructuring. These we thrive on. But the contents of the language have changed since one's parents learned it. New words and phrases like karaoke, jihad, download, and you the man have entered via borrowing and analogy, while other expressions like rumble seat and banana oil have dropped out. And sound change, though slow, upsets parts of the system Mama and Papa perceived by creating, for example, new sets of homonyms. Currently in America, pairs like where, where, whine, wine, which, or caught, cot, hawk, hawk, caller, collar, are becoming indistinguishable. Centuries earlier, pairs like beat, beat, creak, creak, peel, peel did so. This means that baby not only structures the incoming data, but restructures it from the perspective of the parents. Their systems differ. The differences between parent and child are small enough that the two systems are mostly mutually intelligible. Tangles occur more often in the classroom, where students and older teachers differ likewise. About 20 years ago, students began coming into college with a syntactic pattern placing the adverb before the verb instead of after it. No longer, "he ran quickly," but "he quickly ran," a pattern that often sounds terrible to people over 50. But the obscuring differences keep accumulating, and the process accelerates enormously when major cultural changes occur, as with the Norman invasion of England in 1066. Remember the nobleman dining in his chamber. The Middle English of Chaucer is vaguely readable today. The Old English of Beowulf seems a foreign language. Sufficient restructuring, the result of seeking compressive patterns, makes the older language opaque. Just so will we find it with mythology. Chapter 12. Post Hocus, Ergo Pocus. Space Aliens Mutilate Cows. Humane Society offers reward for conviction in heinous cat mutilations. Following reports of the disembowelment mutilation of a pet cat belonging to a Salt Lake Avenue's resident, the Humane Society of Utah has offered a reward of $2,500 for information leading to the identification and conviction of the perpetrator or perpetrators of an act that the director describes as a heinous, revolting manifestation of the very worst impulses that human beings are capable of generating. From www.utahhumane.org, July 2002. You may wonder by now if anyone still thinks according to the principles we've been describing. The answer is clearly affirmative, as can be demonstrated by investigating a modern myth. Periodically, people notice that small pets, dogs and cats, are being killed and mutilated. Indeed, in the epigraph, we see that the Humane Society put out a reward for information leading to the apprehension of those responsible for such a crime. Yet such events scarcely make it into the news. What would make such a story newsworthy? Well, bigger, more valuable animals. In the late 1960s, it was reported that cattle were being killed and mutilated in the western United States. Blame was leveled variously at mysterious sects, space aliens, and government agencies using helicopters. The helicopters were necessary because there wasn't any evidence of tracks of either humans or vehicles in the vicinity of the dead cattle. The mutilations went on for years, then ended for a long time, then were renewed in the fall of 2001. Let's consider the phenomena commonly associated with the cattle mutilations. 1. There was no evident cause of death of the cow. 2. There were no tracks in the vicinity, even in mud or snow. 3. Certain parts of the animal's anatomy had been cut out with surgical precision. 4. The carcass was typically attacked at the tongue, eyes, sex organs, and udders. 5. The affected animals seemed to bloat faster than usual. 6. Cuts were often circular or oval, and sometimes looked as though made with a tool resembling pinking shears. 7. The exposed flesh was sometimes blackened. 8. The carcasses were sometimes left untouched by predators. 9. The perpetrators mysteriously stopped mutilating cows for years on end. If we subject this mystery to the kind of analysis we've been doing, we shall see some of our principles very clearly. This is because the cattle mutilations aren't really much of a mystery at all. When experts on dead animals have investigated them, they have concluded that the animals died of natural causes and that their wounds were proof that scavengers had made a meal of them. But if this is so, then this list of phenomena should be easily explained. And it is. Let's consider the items one by one. 1. No evident cause of death of the cow. evident here seems to mean that there wasn't a bullet hole or bite marks from, say, a mountain lion. But in fact, cattle, like people, die from a multitude of causes, many of which are not at all obvious even with a necropsy. And dead cattle are not commonly given necropsies. 2. No tracks in the vicinity, even in mud or snow. Lack of tracks from people or vehicles doesn't mean anything more than that people and vehicles probably weren't involved in the event. Birds can, of course, alight directly on their prey. The question of animal tracks, however, is very complex. The movies have taught an entire generation of Americans that it's simple and easy to spot animal tracks. Any Western hero can do so at a glance. Tracking, however, is a highly specialized art that takes many years to learn, nor can you easily spot the tracks of even large, heavy animals. One tracking expert observes that he often sees beginning trackers trying to decipher tracks and signs while standing up or sitting on their haunches. He has to make them get down on their hands and knees or even on their belly. Any professional tracker will tell you it means nothing at all if the average person can't see animal tracks, even of large animals. And if you want a real challenge, try tracking your cat through your yard. Many years ago, one of us took lessons from a professional tracker. We followed a large wild pig that had preceded us by about 2 hours. The pig had obligingly walked through a puddle, and the disintegration of the tracks in water enabled the tracker to estimate the time. The tracks appeared and disappeared mysteriously, but the tracker got down on all fours and peered sideways at what appeared to be nothing, then, pointing out details of the nothing, led us on. Our efforts to contribute information eventually led to a nice comedy. Some distance ahead, we saw clear hoof prints going up a hill. There they are, going up the hill. The tracker, without looking up, said, "Nope, those are cow tracks, and they're coming down the hill. The pig will have gone up where it's not so steep." As we got closer, the tracks we had spotted became embarrassingly huge and changed shape. So, it is often not at all easy to detect tracks, even of large animals, and in some circumstances, it is impossible. Moreover, there are powerful reasons for concluding that, although it is indeed animals that are responsible for the cattle mutilations, they are small animals, not large ones. How do we know this? Large animals attack their prey in predictable ways that rule them out. It's easy to identify a mountain lion's kill, for example, because the lion bites into the neck of its prey, and it typically eviscerates large prey and feeds first on the liver. Years ago, when we asked that hunting guide if there were really lots of mountain lions around, as he claimed, he took us around the countryside and showed us several kills of black-tailed deer. One or two he knew of already, others he found by observing turkey vultures. Quickly, it became clear that a mutilated cow and a deer killed by a mountain lion have little in common. But although we can easily rule out large predators in the cattle mutilations, it's not so easy to rule out small scavengers. Keep in mind that the creatures that mutilated the carcass aren't necessarily responsible for the death of the cow. All they had to do is chew on it. And small animals are light on their feet. So let's return to that dead cow and look again for animal tracks. Only now we're looking for the tracks of a badger or fox, or coyote, bobcat, or weasel. We've been told there are no animal tracks, even in mud or snow. But if the scavengers were nocturnal, they may well have approached the carcass at night, when it was very cold. And here it should be pointed out that in areas with low humidity, and especially at higher altitudes, it can be quite hot in the daytime and quite cold at night. The scavenger may have come and gone before snow turned into water and transformed the soil into mud. The mud may have been frozen. The snow may not have fallen yet. The snow may have been frozen hard enough to support the weight of the rather small scavenger. It's important to remember that if people had seen the footprints of scavengers, there would be no mystery. So there's a kind of natural selection for the mysterious. A carcass surrounded by animal tracks and showing clear evidence of bite marks would never make it onto the internet. But let's get on to the evidence that it was in fact scavengers that did the mutilating. 3. Certain parts of the animal's anatomy cut out with surgical precision. This is not nearly so suspicious a circumstance as it seems. Carnivorous animals typically have carnassial teeth where humans have their molars, in the back of the mouth on either side. These form a kind of shears designed for cutting away chunks of meat. This is why your dog chews your new shoes apart with the back teeth on one side of its mouth. Does Fido do so with surgical precision? Our own experiments here, performed with volunteer help from our Australian shepherds, show that animal teeth can make remarkably clean cuts. Rows of smaller teeth make yet cleaner lines. 4. Carcass typically attacked at tongue, eyes, sex organs, udders. Here we are reminded of the remark in Moby Dick that the whale would by all hands be considered a noble dish were there not so much of him. But when you come to sit down before a meat pie nearly 100 feet long, it takes away your appetite. You have probably never pondered what a dead cow would look like to a badger or a ferret, but we suspect much of it would look overwhelming. In fact, what we see here is clearly a choice based not on bizarre rituals, but on what is soft and accessible. The very task of chewing through cowhide would be daunting, let alone getting a small jaw around a large spare rib. So the smaller scavengers, the very ones least likely to leave footprints, attack the carcass at the softest, most accessible places. They attack the udders, tongue, and so forth, not out of perverted bloodlust, but because these are softer than anything else. 5. Seem to bloat faster than usual. This statement is really put backwards. It's the carcasses that bloat faster than usual that are most accessible to small scavengers. This is because the bloating puts pressure on the body from the inside, averting the various soft parts, thereby making them even more accessible to predators. Why would some carcasses bloat faster than others? There are various reasons, the most obvious being that bodies decompose quicker at higher temperatures than at low. A carcass in the sun will bloat faster in general than one in the shade. The mode of death influences the speed of decay as well.